We want to welcome students from Two Rivers High School. Would they please stand? You may be seated. Thank you for coming. The students are here with a program cleverly entitled Caught with Class. Students from around the state are invited to attend an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the materials relating to the case is sent to the students. They might engage in activities relating to the case. They come for an oral argument. And then after the second oral argument, students are here for the first argument and the second. Join, and a justice is assigned to meet with the student and discuss the procedures of the court in accepting and then in deciding the case. Discussion is not about the substantive issues or the merits of the case, and everybody is invited to attend. You don't have to be a student from Two Rivers or Monticello High School, which is who are the students who came in the first one. So with that, let me introduce the court to you. Starting on my far left is Justice Rebecca Bradley. On my far right is Justice Michael Gableman. The second justice in the left is the waving justice.
Good morning.
Annette Ziegler. And on the right, Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left, aside from the empty chair, is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The empty chair is ordinarily occupied by Patience Rogensack, but she's not sitting in on this case. She has recused herself. And I'm Shirley Abrahamson, and you're very lucky because I'm the justice who is going to talk with the students today at or about noon. With those opening remarks, we'll take our second case for the day, which is 13AP 646 CR. State versus Leopoldo R. Salas Gayton. The lineup is as follows. Colleen Ball, Assistant State Public Defender, has 20 minutes representing Mr. Salas Gayton. 5 minutes is devoted to Matthew Pinnix, who is counsel for the Amicus Curiae, Catholic Charities Legal Services for Immigrants. We have 30 minutes by Assistant Attorney General Christopher G. Wren, and 5 minutes for Ms. Ball in rebuttal. Counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the Court. Assistant State Public Defender Colleen Ball appearing on behalf of the petitioner Leopoldo Salas Gayton. This case is about how Wisconsin circuit courts are to sentence undocumented immigrants who have committed crimes. Mr. Salas Gayton is not asking for a special rule. He's asking for a straightforward application of State v. Galyon and deference to the plain language of the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. We know that in sentencing a defendant, that a court considers the gravity of the offense, the protection of the public, and the rehabilitative needs and the character of the defendant. And when a court considers the character of the defendant, it may, of course, consider prior unlawful conduct and uncharged conduct, a broad range of conduct. But State v. Galyon says that when the court does that, it must discuss the facts, state them on the record, and then state how those facts relate to the sentencing objective. Now, that's what Galyon requires, but we also know that what a court may not do is that it may not sentence a defendant more harshly simply because he is a non-citizen or simply because he is, quote, an illegal alien. And we know that from Plyer versus Doe, which says that even immigrants who have entered our country illegally are entitled to due process and equal protection of the law. So what this case really boils down to is the difference between sentencing a defendant based on his conduct versus sentencing a defendant based on an attribute or status as a non-citizen. Now, if you consider the record in Mr. Salas-Gaitone's case, it indicates that he is not a citizen. It indicates that he came here 14 years before sentencing in order to work. But the court said to him, the fact that you are not a citizen goes to your character. The fact that you are an illegal alien is a character flaw. And in doing that, what the court was really doing was sentencing Mr. Salas-Gaitone based on his attribute or status of being a non-citizen or an illegal alien. It did not cite any relevant immigration conduct. It didn't talk about an immigration violation. It didn't describe any facts relating to those circumstances. And it didn't try and take those non-existent facts and description and relate them to the sentencing objective as Galyen requires.
Well, is his presence in the United States a crime?
Absolutely not. Under U.S. versus Corres, illegal entry into the United States is not an ongoing crime. And under Arizona versus United States, a person's presence in the United States after they once entered it illegally is not a crime. The United States Supreme Court was very clear about that. So, yes, Justice Prosser.
If Mr. Wren had committed this offense and he didn't have a driver's license, could that be taken into account?
Mr. Wren, in this instance, would have been convicted of driving without a license and causing homicide, so for sure.
Okay, and if he didn't have any insurance, could that be taken into account?
I'm not sure how insurance is relevant to the crimes of conviction here, Your Honor, so I would argue that that's not relevant under Galyen.
Well, shouldn't the consequences of an offense be taken into account in sentencing?
Your Honor, citizens and non-citizens commit the very crimes that were committed here. And so if you are too poor to have insurance, for example, I don't think we can increase a person's sentence by saying you're indigent because you were too poor to afford insurance. So I think it's not relevant. And to that extent, I would say what you really need to think about here is the different ways that American citizens can lose their license and commit crimes when they don't have license, or commit the homicide by intoxicated use or causing death by driving without a license. It's extremely easy to lose your license in the United States. You can lose it for skipping classes. You can lose it for failure to pay a municipal fine. So unless we're prepared to say, hey, you skipped classes, played hooky when you were in high school, that played a role in the offense of driving without a license and killing someone, I don't think we can take illegal entry into the country into account. And there's a real danger in doing that here, Justice Prosser. One of the reasons is that if you affirm the certain court's record here, what you're really doing is you saying, hey, circuit courts, you can use code words or shorthand references to refer to prior unlawful conduct or driving without a license or things like that. And Galyen says no code words. And Plyer versus Doe says especially not if it's going to be non-citizen or illegal alien. And I use that word in quotations. And I think another danger in affirming the record as it is presented here, as the, using the words that this circuit court judge actually used, is that it permits a circuit court to sentence a person based on implied reasoning, and even worse, what it fails to do is it fails to take into account individualized sentencing, right? Because when we say illegal alien, or if we say non-citizen, or if we say illegal immigrant, that lumps together a whole bunch of people. It would allow the sentencing court to treat the student who came and overstayed a visa for 3 days and committed OWI homicide or homicide without having a driver's license the same as the drug trafficker who entered in order to distribute drugs, the same as the person who fled a country where he was oppressed and there was political upheaval and he came to the United States in order to seek asylum. Under the record as it is presented here, we'd be treating all of those individuals the same. And that's part of what's wrong with what happened here, is just the lack of information, the lack of discussion about the link between conduct and the sentencing objective.
Now, what about the families of the victim and the friends of the victim? At sentencing, are they entitled to address the immigration status of a defendant?
Your Honor, the only limitation I'm aware of on what the victims may say at allocution is in the statute, it refers to relevant. It does use that qualifier relevant, but I want to be very clear here, Justice Prosser. I'm not asking this court to limit victim allocution. I've not requested that. Mr. Salas-Gaitone does not request that. What we want is for the court to examine what it is that the circuit court relied on when it gave its sentencing rationale.
Would the circuit court have been proper to say to family members of the victim, what you're saying about the immigration status of the defendant is not relevant, so you cannot talk about that?
I think the appropriate way to handle this situation, Justice Prosser, is to, of course, acknowledge the tremendous grief that the victims were feeling in this case. And if the circuit court had said to the victims, I acknowledge your grief, I cannot sentence the defendant very gently based on his alienage, and then proceed to say, I have to sentence him based on the character and rehabilitative needs of the defendant, the need to protect the public and so forth, and just proceed with the sentencing hearing from there. Under that situation, the victims are expressing their grief, but the court is making the record that this court and other appellate courts need. It's giving the reviewing courts the assurance they need that it did not rely on an improper, constitutionally impermissible factor when it sentenced the defendant. It also, of course, gives the defendant that assurance, and that's very important.
But you're not asking that the court require that the circuit court say that?
No.
You think that's good practice?
I think that would be very good practice,
okay.
Yes.
Now, the court says here that the court is using illegal alien, or whatever phrase it used, for character, but then didn't go further, as I understand the transcript. So I tried to think about what is the inference. What's the court thinking when it says I'm using it for character? And I decided that the court was thinking, because I don't know this, but the circuit court was thinking that a person who is here without appropriate documents, do we agree that this person does not have appropriate documents?
He has acknowledged that he is an undocumented immigrant.
Okay. So what phrase should we be using here, since this caught the court's attention? The court uses a phrase in its order. Two justices said, hey, that's not the phrase we should be using. We should use a more neutral phrase, not illegal. What was the phrase?
Illegal alien.
Not illegal alien. Alien just means you're not a citizen. And you are not an illegal person. I mean, you're a legal person. Whether you're here legally is another issue. But an illegal alien is not a word or phrase defined in the federal statutes, right? Alien
That's
is
right.
defined. It just means you're not a citizen. You can be here perfectly legally and stay here perfectly legally for many years. You don't have to become an American citizen if you don't want to, right?
That's correct.
Okay. You run risks by not being a citizen, right?
That is correct.
Right. Having had parents who, a mother at least, who was sure to get out her citizenship papers before the Second World War started because she knew she was an alien and was concerned with a war coming that the United States might make different arrangements for non-citizens. So that could happen. Okay, so what's a better word? Undocumented person? Better phrase?
Your Honor, I chose the word undocumented immigrant as I was drafting these briefs, but I think that it might be better to defer to the amicus, who is speaking on behalf of four immigrants' rights organizations today about what the appropriate term might
okay.
be. I would just say this. It might make sense to avoid terms that have become pejorative,
mm-hmm.
but I would like to point out that this case doesn't rest on that, okay? That's one piece that was mentioned in here, but it does not rest on the terms so much that the circuit court used as the fact that it was discriminating based on alienage, okay?
Well,
and non-citizenship.
All right. So the circuit court can consider the character of the defendant, isn't that right?
Yes.
You can consider the character of the defendants if the character is violent,
yes.
right? The character is untruthful,
mm-hmm.
right? So here, from the circuit court's point of view, being in this country as an undocumented immigrant or as an undocumented person means that you aren't paying attention to law, that you're violating the law. And if you violate the law as to one item, you'll violate the laws to other items.
Well, the problem with that is we have clear United States Supreme Court precedent that says it's the entry into the country that may be illegal,
mm-hmm.
but continuing to live here, your continuation, your presence here cannot be unlawful. It's not a crime. What's unlawful is the entry into the country, and I do not...
That's gone. That's 12 or 13 years ago.
13 to 14 years ago. And if the circuit court didn't say this, but if what it meant was that entry into the United States 13 to 14 years ago was prior unlawful conduct, it didn't explain that, but let's just tease that out a little bit. How does the federal government view entry into the United States? It is a petty misdemeanor. It is so, despite what people may think, and there are strong feelings on the subject, federal law treats that as less serious than the crime of reusing a postage stamp. The penalty for entering the United States illegally is up to 6 months in jail and I think about $250 fine. So that's the magnitude of the crime we're talking about, and of course the importance of it diminishes the farther back into the past we go. So 14
years. Is there a statute of limitations?
I do not know. I don't think so, but I don't know. Yes.
Let's say you were running a business. Sort of manufacturing business. Are there limitations or are there any duties about inquiring about immigration status?
I don't know employment law, Your Honor. I do know that there, under Arizona versus United States, it's a serious problem for an employer to hire a person who is undocumented, but it is not a crime for an undocumented person to seek and hold a job in the United States.
Okay, so it could be a crime?
I don't want to say it's a crime, but it's definitely a legal problem. I'd have to. That is directly in Arizona versus United States. That question is answered. So it's a problem for the employer, but it's not a problem for the undocumented immigrant who is an employee. And the reason for that is that you don't want to put them in a position of someone being able to take advantage of them, right? They've already here, and now you can say, aha, you know, you're undocumented, do whatever I say, or I'll turn you into the authorities. So that's the danger that the federal government is guarding against there, is abuse of another person.
Counsel, a couple of excerpts from the circuit court read as follows. The fact that you're an illegal alien doesn't enter into the serious nature of the crime or the need to protect the community. It goes to character. It's a minor character flaw, very honestly. Later on in the sentencing, he also says, you're from the nation of Mexico. Although you're here illegally, it's a factor, a minor factor, but it goes to your character. Even if you are correct that it is error, why is it not harmless error? By the way, there are other excerpts. I just read these two because they mention it's minor. Why doesn't it go to harmless error if it's minor? And as a follow-up to that, I would like you to tell me what the test is, if you can articulate it. Sometimes our court has had great difficulty in articulating the test for harmless error. That's why I say that at sentencing. So what's the test? Why isn't it harmless error?
Well, I'll start with why it's not harmless error, because the case law is very clear that relying on a constitutionally impermissible factor would be a structural error. Bias is one of those, and that's State v. Travis that makes that point. I think the other Wisconsin Supreme Court case that's important here is State v. Landry Harris, and that's the case where the question of the defendant's gender and race came into play. And in that particular case, the Wisconsin Supreme Court said that the circuit court did not rely on race and gender. But the court repeatedly made the point that reliance at all on constitutionally impermissible factors like race, gender, or national origin, that circuit courts or sentencing courts, rather, cannot do that. It didn't address alienage, but my argument is alienage and citizenship are on par with race, national origin, and gender. And really, Justice Bradley, I don't think this case can get to harmless error unless this court is prepared to withdraw that language from State v. Landry Harris, because it was fairly sweeping. So, and as for the harmless error test, I don't think we're going to get there. State v. Travis gave three formulations of it. I'm not entirely sure which one's correct, but I would be prepared to go with that the state has to prove harmless error beyond, that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And if the sentencing court said, I'm taking alienage into account, even just a little bit, even if it's minor, that's enough. If it's one day, that's enough. One day of deprivation of liberty is enough to prove that my client was harmed.
Why did you mention the blood alcohol content of the victim in your brief?
Your Honor, when this court conducts a review of the sentencing record, it may, of course, examine the entire record. And the sentencing court here said several times comments about the victim and said that, you know, minding their own business, et cetera. And that didn't seem 100% true. So it provides context to what happened here. I am in no way, shape, or form asking this court to decide this case based on the victim's blood alcohol content. It's just giving complete context to what happened in this case. Uh, I guess I'd like to try and quickly engage in an exercise that I think might be helpful for this court, and that is between the two of us, we've cited 15 cases to this court that involve trial courts sentencing defendants who are undocumented immigrants. And I think it gets kind of messy, but it's extremely easy to categorize those cases, and it's very easy to create a scorecard. And if you do, you will see that the weight of authority supports the position that Mr. Salas-Guyton has proposed in this case. And the categories are, you have six cases that hold that alienage or illegal immigration status, sometimes in combination with national origin, is not a valid sentencing factor, and even the appearance of relying on those cases requires reversal and a remand for sentencing. And those are Onwemene, Mendoza, Velasquez-Velasquez, Zaval-Ramos, Loing, and Barrero-Izaza. Then you have three more cases that acknowledge the fundamental constitutional principle that we cannot sentence a defendant more harshly based on alienage. But in these cases, the court discussed the entry into the United States. It discussed the facts and circumstances and related them to the sentencing objective. And those were Gomez, Yemsen, and Tovar Pina. And then there are three cases that do support the state's position. And two of those cases are Court of Appeals decisions from the state of Indiana, Guzman versus State and Sanchez v. State. Both of them say that unlawful immigration is a valid aggravating factor. However, neither of those cases acknowledge the fundamental constitutional principle. They don't acknowledge the Equal Protection Clause. They don't acknowledge Plyer versus Doe or Gomez, which seems to be the fundamental case here. And the third case that supports the state is U.S. versus Harneith, and H-R-N-E-I-T-H. That's an unpublished per curiam decision from the 11th Circuit. I question whether we should be discussing it, but if it becomes central, I would just point out that is a case where the circuit court, in my view, didn't do what sentencing courts should do, and that is draw the link between the conduct and the sentencing objective. The last three cases are irrelevant, and I'm happy to discuss them if you like, but they are Flores Olague, Trujillo, and Hernandez Claval.
Ms. Baum, I think you'll agree that there is not and should not be a per se rule that no reference can be made to the status of a person as an undocumented person.
I agree.
Okay. So that means you can, the trial court can consider, rely on the status. The question then becomes when and how much. And if I read your brief right, you want the court to adopt the following test. That the court may consider a defendant's immigration violation, not the fact that he's undocumented, but that there's a violation, as unlawful or uncharged conduct only if this violation is based on accurate and reliable information and only if it is reasonably related to the sentencing decision. Is that the standard you want the court to adopt?
I would add to it that there needs to be some discussion of the circumstances or facts relating to the immigration violation, but yes, that is the rule that I'm advocating. I need to make a clarification, though, Justice Abrahamson. You said you summarized my words as the sentencing court can rely on immigration status, and that is not what I'm saying. I'm saying immigration status can certainly be discussed at sentencing, but we can never have a sentence based on alienage or citizenship. So I need to be careful there.
All right. But, sir, I agree. You do say that over and again and have support in the cases. But you do say that a circuit court may consider a defendant's immigration violation. And your position here is there is no violation.
No, Your Honor. I'm saying entry into the United States
is a violation.
Well, illegal entry into the United States would suggest a violation. Here, the circuit court never talked about illegal entry in the United States. There's no discussion about immigration conduct in this case. Mm-hmm. And that's the essential difference. To illustrate the point, I would say take a look at Gomez and Yemsen and Tovar-Pina. Those are all cases where the court's saying, hey, you've stated on the record that you entered this country illegally, you came here for the purpose of trafficking drugs, or you came here repeatedly after you had been deported, and they're talking about conduct, you know, the violation in the context of conduct, and then saying, I'm sentencing you to whatever because of that. That didn't happen here. There's no discussion of conduct. It's you're an illegal alien.
And there's no record that he entered legally or illegally.
There is no record before the circuit court to that effect. I mean, he acknowledges that he came into this country illegally. That came up post-conviction.
The inference, though, is that the circuit court thought he was violating the federal immigration laws.
Right. That's correct. There's multiple inferences here. I mean, like I said, he would acknowledge that he entered the country illegally, but what the circuit court is doing is it's inferring all the facts and circumstances surrounding that, and then from those non-existent facts and circumstances, it's also inferring a connection to the sentence it imposed. So it's double inferences, and Galleon teaches no implied inferences. My time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Christopher Wren, the amicus curiae. Go ahead. You've got 5 minutes, Mr. Pinnix.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Matthew Pinnix, and I represent Catholic Charities and the other legal service organizations that filed an amicus brief in this case urging for the fair treatment of non-citizens before Wisconsin's sentencing courts. There are certainly lofty principles discussed in the briefing in this matter with regard to the Constitution and the rights that persons enjoy. And while we see that as significantly important to guide this court in its decision, we see this case really about the nuts and bolts of how Wisconsin judges can be sure that when they sentence a non-citizen, they do it right. And they do it constitutionally, and they don't have to worry about getting reversed on appeal. We see this case almost as a corollary, if you will, to Padilla versus Kentucky, which was the United States Supreme Court case that said, criminal defense attorneys, you need to be sure that when you are working with non-citizens that you are careful because there are significant issues in the intersection between criminal law and immigration law. This case is not about the criminal defense bar. It's about Wisconsin's sentencing judges, and this is your opportunity to inform those judges about the difficulties that come about when a non-citizen comes before the court to be sentenced, because there are very important constitutional issues involved, and those are the need to ensure that the sentence is based not only on accurate and reliable information, but is based also on the fact that the person, is not based on something like the person's alienage or their citizenship status. Given the fact that those are considerations that are likely to again occur, we want this court to write an opinion in telling Wisconsin's sentencing judges that when a non-citizen defendant comes before them, they need to be particular in the language that they use to describe the reasons for the sentence that they are giving. We want them to use language that reflects whether they are sentencing the defendant on the basis of conduct or on the basis of status. Because conduct is fine. Status is not. If you're going to judge against, as an aggravating factor, criminal defendant, the fact that perhaps he or she had violated the law by entering the country, such should be said. Because if shortcuts are taken, as may have been taken in this case, where the court uses terms like illegal immigrant or illegal or a non-citizen, you run the risk of saying that you're sentencing the person because of their status as an illegal immigrant or their status as a non-citizen. And those things are not permissible. Certainly, if the court were to be more particular and to say, we are sentencing, sentencing judge, am sentencing this defendant because he or she may have improperly entered the country or may have otherwise unlawfully entered the country, that will focus on the conduct and not the status. The one is permissible, the other is not. And it's important for this court to take this case as an opportunity to clarify that, because if it does not, given
what about the conduct of being here and not having appropriate documents?
Your Honor, that was addressed correctly by Ms. Ball, that indeed it is not an ongoing violation of criminal
the entry.
Law.
Mm-hmm.
Entry is correct. Mm-hmm. To come into the country, entry can violate the statute. But there are, as we point out in our brief, mitigating circumstances in which a person may come into the country unlawfully, but yet be allowed to remain here. And that is why we're asking for the sentencing court to be particular in the language and also to be sure that when sentencing a defendant, to tie in the connection between the offense at sentencing and the conduct that is being considered. Because indeed, there are circumstances in which persons may come here for asylum, for example, and be allowed to remain. And their entry may be violative of the federal code, but they nonetheless thereafter are given the right to remain by federal immigration authorities. And that, I think, is a good point at which to mention that we don't want to have the Wisconsin sentencing judges have to get buried in the complexity of the federal immigration code trying to ascertain whether or not a particular individual has violated the law upon entry. We have a full body of administrative law judges who do only that in order to ensure that a person's immigration status is properly
sorted out. What should the court have said here? What should the circuit court have said in this case if they want to consider that we're dealing with an undocumented person?
For me to answer that question, Justice Abrams, I have to say, make some assumptions
about
what the court meant when it used those words.
Right.
Because quite frankly, given the record before the court, it seems to me that what the judge was doing something impermissible, was saying that you're a non-citizen and that's a character flaw, or saying that you're an illegal immigrant and that's a minor issue.
Can I ask you the question a little bit differently? The sentencing court said you're here illegally. If instead the sentencing court said you came here illegally, would that have been permissible?
If the court has, and we are asking for the rule to be reliable and verifiable information that indeed there was some unlawful entry by the defendant, then that would be a proper consideration for the court to articulate, so long as the court then reasonably connected it to the sentence that was being given. And that's on the basis of Galleon authority in this court's general description of how defendants should be sentenced.
Could he have obtained a driver's license?
But no, he cannot.
Okay, and wasn't count three directly related to not having a driver's license?
That is correct.
Okay. How do we know the court wasn't just piecing together his sentence on count three?
We don't know that because the court didn't say it, and that's the problem. I mean, the court needs to be specific in the language that it is using so that this court or other reviewing courts can be sure that in the future he hasn't sentenced the individual on the basis of his citizenship or his national origin. The lack of specificity is something that we as the amici are suggesting should be resolved for future cases in which a non-citizen defendant comes before the court to be sentenced. Thank you.
Did the defendant have an interpreter in this case?
My review of the sentencing transcript indicates that he did at the time of sentencing. I can't speak to any of the other portions of the case or even in his arrest and detention. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Now, Mr. Wren, Assistant Attorney General of the State of Wisconsin, representing the State of Wisconsin. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Christopher Wren, Assistant Attorney General, appears on behalf of the State of Wisconsin.
We haven't seen you for a while. Where have you been?
I've been ensconced in my office, and they don't give me the cases that bring me here.
Okay. Well, we're going to try harder, Mr. Wren.
I want to start out because one of the points that was made in the brief, and I think that a lot of their case hinges on this, is they talk about the speculation, lack of substantiation of this claim at sentencing about whether he was, in fact, an illegal alien, to use the phrase the judge used. I want to point out, and that appears in Mr. Salas Gaetan's brief at 29, and his reply brief at 8, and the legal organization's amicus brief at 9. I want to make the point that this was, in fact, known well before the sentencing. And that's one of the reasons that I think it was not mentioned in great specificity at the sentencing. There was a police report on January 5th, and that appears actually as an attachment to the post-conviction motion. This is January 5th, 4 days after the collision, where a Milwaukee sheriff's detective wrote the report saying that he had contacted Immigration and Customs Enforcement agent about Mr. Gaetan, and that Mr. Gaetan had stated that he was an illegal alien in the United States of America for the past 13 years. So that's already known 4 days after the collision. The next day, at the initial appearance, the prosecutor informed the judge, quote, "I'm also aware that the defendant is in this country illegally." And then another couple of weeks later, at a scheduling conference where they were talking about the bond and whether he should be released on a bond, the defense counsel said, "I believe he also has an ICE holding, ICE being Immigration and Customs Enforcement. I don't know if he would be able to be released anyway." So when they say that this was that the only source for this information at the sentencing was from the statements by the supporters of Corey Damsky, it's simply not true. The court, the prosecutor, defense counsel all knew this before going into the
knew what?
Knew that he was here, he was present in the United States unlawfully.
Well, isn't that really one of the questions? What does that mean? I would have assumed it meant that if you weren't documented to stay in this country, you were here illegally. But the other briefs say, not true, not true. You needn't have the documentation, and that is not a criminal offense under the federal laws. That the offense is entering illegally, but we don't know if he entered illegally or not. 40% enter legally as a total, if I believe these reports. So I think if you asked most lawyers who don't know too much about immigration law, that would include me, what does it mean to say the person is here illegally? I said it doesn't have documents allowing him to stay. That doesn't seem to be what the federal law is. The federal law means if you entered illegally, that is a misdemeanor offense, but it's not an offense to get a job. It's
right.
Not an offense to stay here. So I agree with you that this information was available, and it didn't depend on the victim's statements or any other things. It was available from the police reports. But I don't know what it means.
Well, I think it's certainly correct that being in this country without documentation, once you've entered illegally, is not denominated as a crime. It's not denominated in the statutes. But my understanding is that it does make you deportable. And
right.
I don't think you can be deported without being in violation of something.
Well, you're in violation of
being undocumented.
Being undocumented.
Right.
But that's
which
deportable.
Is
yeah.
Which is conduct.
Yeah, but it's not a crime.
And it doesn't have to be a crime to be considered as going to character. It doesn't have to be considered. When we do the sentencing, we have the three mandatory requirements. We have the severity of the offense, the protection of the public, and the character of the offender. And the fact that he entered illegally, which is I don't think anybody is actually disputing, that's conduct. That goes to character. His own attorney agreed with that at the sentencing proceeding. And one of the reasons she agreed with it is because she knew it. One of the things we don't have here, it's like the Silver Blaze story from Arthur Conan Doyle, the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime. What was the curious incident? That the dog didn't bark. Well, what we don't have here is an ineffective assistance of counsel claim based on a failure to correct the record or whatever it is that a defense attorney who knew something different would have done. I think that's one of the reasons that we don't have the explicit explanation that Mr. Salas-Gaitan is asking for, because all the parties who were involved had this information, knew it, and were working on those assumptions. So, I mean, I want to make sure that you understand. I agree that it would be nice if the judges were more explicit, regardless of whether it's the immigration status or anything else, were more explicit about how they make their sentencing decision. But the fact is that the judge here did not rely on alienage. What we have here is a slate of words, I think, where saying illegal alien, illegal immigrant, is the equivalent of referring to alienage.
So are you saying that the judge can consider that the defendant is deportable? He can consider that as a character aspect, attribute, that he can consider it on sentencing?
I'm saying that the fact that he's here without documentation is conduct.
Yes,
it's not a status. And that conduct makes him deportable.
All right, I agree with that.
And so it's not that he's deportable that makes him that he's taken into account. It's the fact that this is conduct that is in violation of federal law, even if it's not criminal law.
Doesn't that get us really deep into immigration law? What about the children who come here as infants? They're referred to as the Dreamers, you know, the Dream Act. I mean, are we going to have to know, if we're going to be able to use what you indicate, that you're undocumented and that goes to conduct, then don't we need to know more to have any plausible relevance? What if they're here undocumented seeking asylum because of a persecution in their home country, wherever they may be? So, it seems to me you're getting us into the circuit court judges deep into the weeds of immigration law when you indicate that broad statement without a more nuanced approach.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily getting into the weeds. I think there are a couple of responses to that. One is, that's part of the defense attorney's job, to apprise the judge if there's some concern about this. And if what we're talking about is that every time somebody comes in to a sentencing who is an undocumented immigrant, I think that the defense attorney should know that and should make clear, if there are mitigating circumstances on that, what those mitigating circumstances are. I'm not saying that, and in fact, the judge here said, you're an illegal alien, and not as is in the defense's brief, multiple times, said it once. And that's a term that appears repeatedly in the federal statutes as well. So I don't think we can fault the judge for using a term that the federal government itself is using in its statutes to describe Mr. Salas-Gaitan. So the first thing is that it's the defense attorney's job to bring those concerns to the attention of the court. And the second thing is that the judge himself or herself, I think, one of the things we do with sentencing is to give the judge discretion about how much to weigh these factors. And if the judge here actually weighed those factors, said your status, your position as an illegal alien, it's really minor. It doesn't even go to the severity of offense. It doesn't go to anything except your character, and it's really a minor concern for the judge. In a couple of other circumstances, he got a benefit from being an immigrant. When the judge said, I'm not going to take into account your non-cooperation with
it. But here it seems, excuse me, but here it seems as though the judge was referencing his presence as being illegal. Is that incorrect?
Well, it's a violation of I think it's a violation of, you can't be, I don't think you can be deported unless you're in violation.
So the answer to my question is it correct? Is his presence in this country illegal?
I'm not an immigration lawyer, but based on, I think that what's being narrowly parsed here is it's not criminal.
Okay.
My
question is it considered illegal?
I think it's considered unlawful. Because if it weren't unlawful, I don't think he could be deported, and or become deportable. And I don't think they're arguing that if you're here without documentation, you can't be deported.
No.
There may be ways of remedying that, but at least at the time that Mr. Sailor-Caton was sentenced, he had not taken steps to remedy it, as far as anybody's claim. Certainly, his defense attorney didn't say that he was making any efforts to correct that. I think what we've got is that what I've heard and read in the briefs is that saying somebody is an illegal immigrant, an illegal alien, even an undocumented immigrant, whatever those terms are, that somehow that is automatically equivalent to what we agree is an improper sentencing factor, alienage. Being an undocumented immigrant is not equivalent to alienage. Certainly, an undocumented immigrant is an alien, but we're talking about somebody who's being qualified by a subclass of immigrants.
So you acknowledge that alienage is an improper factor at sentence?
I said as much in the brief. Yeah. Alienage, nationality, national origin. You can't be... you can't be an illegal Croatian. You can't be illegally an illegal nationality. There's no such thing as, in a sense, an illegal nationality. There is such a thing as being an immigrant. There's such a thing as being an immigrant who is undocumented. And there's a distinction between the two. You can't sentence just. I don't think the judge could say, "Well, you're an immigrant. I'm going to bump the sentence 5 years." No, I don't think you can do that, because being an immigrant, unqualified, I think would put you in a position of alienage.
You mean non-citizen rather than immigrant? Is that what you're referring to?
Non-citizen, whatever.
I'm asking, yeah. Because, I mean, we are all children of immigrants in this state, right? Some of us a little more closely related to the immigrant in our heritage than others, but so...
As I recall, the definition of immigrant is anyone who is an alien within the United States, except for this 22 exceptions. An alien is an alien itself is defined. So when I'm referring to an immigrant, what we're talking about is somebody who, by definition, is not a citizen of the United States. It's an alien under the language, and I know language is a big issue here, and I understand that, but we're also talking about federal statutes that use that term. In my brief, I tried to make an effort not to use a loaded term. I instead of choosing undocumented immigrant or illegal alien or anything like that, what I chose to use was the phrase a person illegally in the United States or illegally present in the United States, a person unlawfully present in the United States. Those, in fact, are terms that are also used in federal statutes. But I think that's, in a sense, less loaded than the terms we're talking about now, given the current climate. But the fundamental point is that what we're talking about is conduct. And being an immigrant is not, in and of itself, conduct that a judge can enhance a sentence for. But being an immigrant who's undocumented, who entered illegally, I think that conduct can be taken into account. And then it's up to the judge, with the assistance of the prosecutor making his or her position known, or defense counsel making his or her position known, to explain why that's an aggravating or a mitigating circumstance. And in this case, I think that the judge said, it's minor. It really doesn't matter to me. What mattered to the judge, when you read the entire sentencing transcript, he was appalled by the drunk driving and the nature of the collision itself. And that, I think that comes through repeatedly.
Do you think he was appalled by the fact that here's a person who's lived in this country almost 14 years and doesn't take responsibilities as a person who's lived here, doesn't have a driver's license, sometimes is homeless, has a job?
I don't think the judge was taking that, saw that as important at all. I don't think Judge Simple was harboring the kind of animus that you would see in some of these other cases, where in fact the courts were concerned about what the judge's attitude was towards somebody who was a non-citizen.
Now, I think that there's agreement between the defendant and the state that there are times when a judge can consider whether the person is appropriately documented to stay in the country.
Are you talking about a person who's here legally?
Well, I have trouble with legal and illegal, okay, because we agree that if they entered unlawfully, that is a misdemeanor.
Right.
We don't have a statement in the law that says if you stay here and you don't have appropriate documents to allow you to stay here, that that's illegal. What we have is it might be grounds for deportation.
Hmm. Right.
That's as far as we can go. You then take the next step, the state takes the next step and says, if there are grounds for deportation, that means your being here is unlawful because you won't be deported unless it's unlawful. But there are just umpteen exceptions to deportability also. So you can't say just because you're deportable and they can bring an action against you that that's unlawful presence here, because you could have perfectly good defenses under the law.
Sure.
Okay.
And those are defenses that can be raised. They were not raised in this case.
This is not a deportation case.
No, I understand that. But my point is that being here is still unlawful.
You're making that decision. I can't find that in the federal statutes, that it's unlawful. I find grounds for deportation with exceptions.
Right.
I don't find that the presence is unlawful. I find it as grounds for deportation. You're saying, well, they can't deport you unless it's unlawful.
Unless you're in violation of federal law.
With all the exceptions that they have. And so that's my problem. But my point of the question is, you can sometimes, the circuit court can sometimes consider it. So what kind of test would you have? What kind of instructions would you give the trial court of when a sentencing court may consider that a defendant is undocumented?
When a defendant, what may consider when the defendant is undocumented?
That's right. Doesn't have papers saying you can stay here for as long as you want or until June 30th, whichever comes first.
Well, again, I'll simply come back and say that being undocumented subjects you to deportation, and that is conduct that is in fact ongoing. Whether it's serious or not is a different question, I think. But it does, if he has not taken any steps and his defense counsel has not indicated to the court or anybody else that he had taken any steps to cure.
Your test is that any time the defendant is, I think this is a quote from your brief, at, if I can read this, pay at footnote 8, so, that it's, that in a legal presence in the United States, the court can consider it.
I'm sorry, which one?
Illegal presence in the United States is good enough for the court to consider.
I think that that is one of the factors under character analysis that the court can take into account, and then it's a that is subject to review for an erroneous exercise of discretion in terms of attaching weight to it. We give sentencing courts a lot of leeway, but I think you could find situations where in relation to the crime that's been committed, that taking that into account would amount to an erroneous exercise of discretion because it's putting too much emphasis on it.
In addition to discretion and lots of leeway, you think it's harmless error anyway because the defendant here, by drunk driving, killed someone.
I think it's harmless error because it's not, in part because it's not structural error. If you were to consider it, if you were to accept their argument that a reference to somebody being an illegal alien or an illegal immigrant is equivalent in all circumstances, basically relying on alienage, nationality, national origin, then I think you've got a structural error.
How do you answer the argument that studies show that when the person is not a citizen, the sentences on the average go up or the medians go up?
I don't know what to make of those statistics because I have no idea what the actual circumstances of that of each particular crime was. I mean, that's one of the things I pointed out. This court has specifically approved or recognized 14 separate sentencing discretionary sentencing factors. That alone can provide for a wide range, depending on which factors the judge chooses. As I pointed out, there are 16,383 possible combinations of those 14 sentencing factors. So it's not a surprise that you're going to get a wide range of sentences in that post-Crescent series that was cited. You had sentences ranging all the way from basically probation up to like 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know the specific circumstances of each of those cases. In the same way, giving an average of what citizens and non-citizens might get for sentences, I have no idea what the various circumstances of those were. So I don't make much of the fact that there may be what appear to be on the surface disparities, when in fact underneath there may be very significant differences in terms of the severity defense of the offense and the need to protect the public.
So how would you write the opinion, Mr. Wren?
Well, I would I would write the opinion to say that it's not improper for a circuit court to rely on a person's conduct, the illegal entry or continuing presence in the United States without documentation. I think that goes to the conduct of the person. It goes to character. And I think it's appropriate for the judge to take that into account. I don't think that those terms equate with alienage, nationality, or national origin any more than they do with race or other prohibited factors. I would also say that in taking that into account, the court's weight, the weight that a court attaches to that kind of factor, is subject to the erroneous exercise of discretion standard.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is very case-specific. In this case, the judge has said specifically it's a minor factor. It's not much. He said that twice. What you get is page after page after page in the sentencing statements of his anger at the drunk driving and the way this occurred. Drunk driving the wrong way on the interstate without any concern for the safety of others. As to whether it's structural error or harmless error, I would say it's not structural error. It's subject to harmless error analysis for the same reasons, because of the emphasis that the court put on the severity of the offense. Whatever references he made to illegal alien, again, once in the context of saying that it goes to the character of the individual, and that the defense counsel agreed with that, I think that we've got a harm. This court can say that any reference in this case, to Mr. Salas-Gaton's status as, as an immigrant, an illegal immigrant in this instance, is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think that this court has said that the harmless error standard is the same regardless of whether it's a constitutional or statutory violation. And I think I've always operated anyway on the assumption that the state's burden was to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it wasn't harmless.
The state burden is what?
I believe that my understanding is that it's to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that it's not harmless, or that it is harmless, I should say.
What would structural error mean in this case?
In this case, if this court concluded that a reference to illegal alien was the equivalent of a reference to alienage or national origin or nationality, and the court relied on it, that would be structural error, because it's not permissible to sentence a person based on alienage, national origin, or nationality.
But
we don't accept the equivalence of
What would the consequence be?
The consequence would be an automatic vacating of the sentencing in this case, and a remand for new sentencing. And then the question becomes, do you remand it for sentencing before the same judge or before a different judge?
Mr. Wren, you said that when I asked you how you'd write the opinion, that it's not improper for the trial court to rely on illegal presence, because this is conduct.
Yes.
And it goes to character. So the inference is, if you engage in illegal conduct by staying in the United States, then you're a person who engages in illegal conduct, and that is a character flaw and can be taken into account in sentencing. I mean, is that what you have in mind?
Essentially, which is the same way we treat other kinds of illegal conduct.
Right, if there was a forfeiture for jaywalking. Hmm. He could take that into mind that he doesn't obey laws. That might be especially important because it's a traffic law.
I think that any violation
of any law.
Yeah, and then it's up to the judge to say, I don't really care about that. I mean, in this case, there were allegations that he had been charged with some other crimes, and the prosecutor himself said, don't pay attention to that. We really can't verify it. Even if it was unverified conduct, even if it was uncharged conduct, shall we say, the court could have taken it into account. The prosecutor said, don't do that.
Parking tickets. You could take them into consideration, because it means you're not obeying the law.
I think that
you don't obey little laws, you don't change
I'm not,
the barrier, you're not
no,
going to obey
I'm
big
not,
laws.
I'm not distinguishing. I think it's a question of what the prosecutor wants to argue for, what the judge wants to take into account, mm-hmm. and then it's a question of the exercise of discretion. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if somebody has a parking ticket, if somebody has a speeding ticket 20 years ago, I don't think the judge is going to really care about that. And in the similar, I mean, we already had Mr. Salas-Gaton with previous violations of the traffic laws. Judge was perfectly entitled to take that into account. So I don't think it's that the seriousness or the lack of seriousness in the offense is a question. It's really a question of what comes to the judge's attention and what the judge wants to take into account in his or her discretion.
As I understand your arguments, it really relies on that if you're undocumented, you're deportable. And you couldn't be deportable unless your presence was unlawful. That's what I hear you saying. Yet your opposing counsel cites Arizona versus the United States, which says in part, as a general rule, it is not a crime for a removable alien to remain in the United States.
It's not a crime, right. I'm not saying it's a crime. It's a crime.
something can be unlawful without being a crime.
Right. Exactly. I mean, technically, forfeitures are not crimes, but they're violations. So, yes, our position is that it doesn't have to be a crime in order to be something that the court can take into account in the character analysis. And, again, I think in the context of in reading this sentencing transcript, I mean, unless we want to call Judge Simple a racist or a hidden bigot or something like that, I don't think there's anything in this record to suggest that he was using alienage, national origin, nationality as a, or using the term illegal alien as sort of a cat's paw for that. It's a fact. You're an illegal alien. You've acknowledged that. There's nothing in the record from defense counsel. And again, I come back to defense counsel because I think part of this is, given what we hear about the complexity of this, is that it's going to become a burden, a significant obligation, much like under Padilla, of the defense counsel to provide information not only to the defendant but to the court where it bears on these kinds of factors.
So because from your perspective it is unlawful civil conduct, it is a proper subject for consideration at sentence.
Yes, that's our position, yes. No further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Wren. Ms. Ball?
I disagree with many things that opposing counsel said, but I want to zero in on one particular thing that I sense the members of the court are struggling with, and it's this idea of unlawful presence, which opposing counsel mentioned several times, continuing presence, illegal presence, the idea that it might be a violation of civil law versus criminal law. And if you look at Plyer versus Doe, the immigrants that were the subject of that particular case had entered the country illegally, and the court said, doesn't matter. Due process and equal protection applies to all immigrants. We don't care whether they entered illegally or not. We don't care whether they can control their status or not. Due process and equal protection apply. Well, I think this case can be resolved on that basis. However, because counsel keeps bringing up this sort of status or existence or presence problem, I would urge the court to maybe take a look at a different vein of cases, and that would be, I think it's Robinson versus California, that talks about this idea of being, of whether or not you can punish someone based on status, and you can't. And in that particular case, what the United States Supreme Court was talking about was drug addiction, okay? And they say you cannot punish someone for being a drug addict. You certainly can punish them for using a drug or for possessing and using, but you can't punish them on their status, okay? And the court lists other examples like that, too, one of them being you can't punish someone for having a sexually transmitted disease, right? Some people will have control over whether they get it. Some people will have control over whether they cure it, but you can't punish them based on status. And that's kind of the situation that we have here. We're singling out a group of people based on status, and the status is their status as immigrants, and in this particular case, I'd say undocumented immigrants. And this is just a very important, I guess, concept and distinction to be making here, because I see the importance of this case is that we're telling, or this court will teach the circuit courts, what are you going to do when undocumented immigrants come before you? How are you going to handle the situation? And the facts and circumstances are going to change all the time. The immigration statuses will change all the time. Some people will have claims to immigration status or to lawful presence, lawful permanent residence, or other grounds for being in the United States, and some people won't. The lens that the circuit court applies always has to be the same from case to case to case to case. And that protocol or that lens we have right here, it's Galleon, and it says, listen, if you're going to take into account prior unlawful conduct, then you better cite the facts, talk about them, then relate them to the sentencing objective, the sentence that you're imposing. In this case, we do know that this defendant, he has acknowledged that he entered the country illegally. Now, opposing counsel would like this court to say, it's okay if everybody had it in their head, but they didn't talk about this on the record. No, that's not okay under Galleon. No implied inferences. The judge didn't talk about immigration conduct. He didn't even use the words illegal entry in the United States. He didn't identify an immigration offense. If we had said, Mr. Salas-Gaitone, you are a shoplifter. You shoplifted 14 years ago. You're a shoplifter. It goes to your character. That wouldn't be enough. That's not enough. You have to talk about the offense, and particularly if it's in the distant past, and you have to relate it to the sentencing objective. That didn't occur here. What we had in this case were code words. They were shorthand references, and the reason it's a big concern in this particular case is that the code words happen to be illegal alien and non-citizen, which are constitutionally impermissible factors. And so this is why, in this case, we need to have a reversal and a remand for new sentencing. No matter which way you try to slice this case, if you say that the court sentenced the defendant on the words, you're an illegal alien, that's a character flaw, you get reversal under Plyer versus Doe. If you infer that the court says that the sentencing court meant Salas Gaitone's presence in the United States is unlawful, you have to reverse under the United States or Arizona versus United States. And if you infer that the court was, when it said non-citizen illegal alien, it meant prior unlawful conduct, you have to reverse under Galleon. All roads lead to reversal here, and that's the fair result if we want sentencing courts to apply the same lens, the same protocol from case to case to case.
Thank you, Ms. Ball. On behalf of the court, I want to thank all three attorneys, Ms. Ball, and Mr. Wren, in a new twist, at least for us, on references to immigrants. We've had other cases that deal with the advice that has to be given either by defense counsel or by the judge. But this is our first one relating to the sentencing per se. That concludes our argument in 13AP 646 CR, State versus Salas-Gaitone. The students, if they can, should remain, and I'll be out in a few seconds to talk with them. Anyone who wishes to stay for the conversation.